This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, recently uncovered documents show that the FBI held a day-long strategy meeting with TransCanada Corporation 2 years ago.
It's nice to know that our own FBI is an adjunct to those who want to build the pipeline.
We'll discuss the continuing and bitter dispute between the CIA and the U.S. Senate committee that oversees it.
At bottom, it's a fight about will the torture carried out by the CIA be revealed? And the fight has turned Dianne Feinstein from a lapdog into an attack dog.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, last week I got a text from you from Florida asking me for the names of some guild members who might help with legal observing. What were you doing there?
Well, that was near Lakeland, Florida, and those were guild members from the Tampa area. I was there because, as people who listen to our show regularly know, my son and his partner both work for this incredible organizing effort called the Coalition for Immokalee Workers, which are primarily Mexican, Guatemalan workers in southern Florida who pick tomatoes, and some 90% of the tomatoes on the East Coast come from this area in Florida. And of course, they get paid terrible wages, and there's wide abuse in the field. And CIW, as it's known, has been organizing for 20 years, and they have been starting to win very big in the last number of years. They've gotten almost every fast food chain on board to sign the Fair Food Agreement.
Did Wendy's sign?
Almost everyone, but not Wendy's. So when you go to Wendy's, you know, that's that pigtailed girl with the red hair. You go in, and if you go in, don't buy anything, but say, how come you haven't signed the Fair Food Agreement? So Wendy's is, out of all the fast food chains, is the only one that hasn't signed yet, and it includes a penny a pound more if they sign, and may and importantly includes being able to monitor abuse in the fields, which is rampant, every kind of abuse from just, you know, beatings to sexual abuse, and it also allows CIW to educate workers on their rights in the fields. It's a worker-run organization. Wendy's has not signed, and they also a big supermarket in the southeast, Publix, has not signed. Now, what's amazing is Walmart has signed. So you can look at what outliers Publix and Wendy's are. In any case, there was a one-month series of demonstrations from Columbus through the southeast and into Florida. Columbus, which is the headquarters of Wendy's, had 850 people outside Wendy's headquarters. It was fabulous. I, of course, being a, what would you call it? You wouldn't say that I'm a demonstration junkie.
You're a demonstration veteran.
I only went for the last 2 days. And I wound up, I flew to Jacksonville, and I went to the Jacksonville Wendy's demonstration and Publix, and there were 150 high school students on the demonstration who'd gotten slips from their school to miss school and joined the demonstration, and they all spoke about what this struggle meant for them. And of course, it was wonderful because it was a very diverse high school. It had everything from African Americans to Latinos to Asians to blacks, every kind of religion. It was fabulous to see these people all out in support for CIW and telling both Wendy's and Publix to sign the Fair Food Agreement. From there, we went to Lakeland, which is the headquarters of Publix, where the demonstration was all night, 24-hour vigil, all night, and then met on Saturday with a very large delegation, something like 1,000 people on a march. The Bishop of Orlando came out with a statement very strongly supporting CIW. It's an incredibly important struggle. I urge you to go to their website, CIW-online.org, CIW-online.org. You'll learn about the struggle, and you'll also see a number of videos, short ones, that my son, who does video for them on these marches, although normally he's a straight organizer, does the videos, and he did a number of them, and they're really excellent and moving.
Are you in any of them, Michael?
I saw the videos last night, and I can say, thankfully, no. I'm just teasing you, Michael. We'll put the videos up on our website, lawanddisorder.org, also.
What's your analysis on what's happening in the Ukraine, Michael?
we've covered the Ukraine on here before, and we've talked about how this was a really an effort by the United States and the West destabilize Ukraine, bring it into the Western orbit, force them to sign an agreement that wouldn't allow them to trade with Russia and that would allow troops on Ukrainian soil. And then what Steve Cohn, who is an expert on the Ukraine and the Soviet Union and Russia, described it as essentially a coup going on by the United States against Ukraine. And that's exactly what happened. The U.S. and the West essentially got its way and overthrew the government of the Ukraine. And now they have a country that they claim will belong to the West. That's really the narrative. What shocks me, and what I really just want to just mention briefly, is how awful and how terrible the coverage is in the New York Times and every other newspaper. Basically, making Putin look like the bad guy here. He's the one that's trying to take off the Crimea from this independent country, going on and on along that line, basically reinforcing the narrative that this is nothing to do with a coup by the United States and other Western countries, but this is actually a Russia. Russia's the bad country here. And then Putin, in this incredible speech that he gave the other day, 47 minutes, went after the United States and said, look, we were weakened after the Soviet Union collapsed. You guys took advantage of us. You're pressing in from all the sides, and that's what's going on in the Ukraine. And with regard to the Crimea, I don't think there's any issue. I mean, that is part of Russia and will be, or a separate country, whatever it'll be. But it should be that the Ukraine should have had the chance to really express itself in the way it meant to express itself without the interference from the United States and the West.
Most organized forces in the coup, because that's what it was, the government of the Ukraine, we may not have liked it. It was headed up by this corrupt oligarch, but it was nonetheless an elected government. And it was overthrown by elements led by fascists who have historical roots going all the way back to the Nazis in the late 30s and 1940s, outright fascists who were writing, "Jews live here" on the walls of people's homes. And that's the kind of government the United States encouraged and supported and financed and installed. That's what you have right now in the Ukraine.
So just don't listen to U.S. people like Kerry and others who are saying what Russia is doing is illegal, it's outrageous. You know, we're the West, we're wonderful in all this. It's a very, very different story. Read up, listen, and think about the narrative you're being spoon-fed by all the media in the United States.
Michael, it seems as though for several years we've been covering the case of the Vulcan firefighters who brought a lawsuit saying that the New York City was essentially using an antiquated and discriminatory application to apply to be a firefighter.
A test.
There were a lot of things wrong with the recruitment for the New York City Fire Department. It's the biggest fire department in the United States, the second biggest in the world, actually. And when the Center for Constitutional Rights got involved in this case, along with a wonderful friend of mine and an incredible lawyer, Richard Levy, the New York City Fire Department was 3% black in a city that's 27 to 30% black. You think about that statistic, and I don't think you need much else. I mean, what are you saying? And they've been complaining about the fire department for 20 years. And of course, for 20 years, we've had Giuliani as a mayor for 8, Bloomberg for 12. 8 plus 12 is 20. At least 20 years, nothing was done. In fact, worse, the fire department continued its discriminatory practices, 3% black in a city 27% black.
And Latino.
There was also huge discrimination on Latinos. The city is also 24, 25% Latino. The fire department was about 8% Latino. Both of those numbers are extraordinary. You shouldn't have to litigate a case like that. A mayor who had the interests of the people of New York, which are about 50% black and Latino, should be saying, well, maybe I should have the interests of those people and make sure we have a non-discriminatory fire department. But as you said, Heidi,
they fought this to the bitter end.
To the absolute bitter end.
Even after they lost, they wouldn't settle.
It was incredible. And Richard Levy, the lead lawyer in the case, and they finally settled it. Richard Levy said in 2007, when Richard had brought the case with the Center for Constitutional Rights, the case could have been settled for $10 million. That's not the key part of the case. The key part is, you know, the test has been changed. There has to be all kinds of outreach in black and Latino neighborhoods. All kinds of other factors are going on. But the number was $10 million. Well, the city recently just had to settle for $100 million, basically. $100 million for back pay.
The clock was running because Bloomberg wouldn't settle it. He had all those years to settle it. Richard Levy said, we ought to present this bill to Bloomberg.
And that was one of Richard's great comments.
So did de Blasio coming into office have any impact?
Richard says it was night and day. Richard says, and Zach Carter, who is the city's corporation council, also. And they played apparently a very important role in finally putting this case to rest. But, you know, I've watched this in my life in the city for really 20 or 30 years. I've been wanting this case to happen for years. And when we brought the case, we actually couldn't get, for whatever reason, another civil rights organization to do it. You know, a normal one that would do this, you know, whatever they are. And Richard Levy finally, with the center, was able to do this case.
So let me ask this. Now that it's settled, going forward, how soon does the city have to implement changes, for example, in the test that they administer to prospective firefighters?
I think the test has already happened. It's being implemented. And they have goals of the number of people who are to take the test, because one of the problems has been the fire department only did outreach in the areas where their people were from, which is primarily Irish Americans. That's where they did outreach. So now there's a high requirement for the number of people who take the test who have to be Latino or African American. Now, one thing, if you listen to the lawyers, including Richard and Darius Cheney, who's the center lawyer on this case, they say, look, this is the beginning of the end of the problem. It's not the end.
Because then there's oversight, right?
There's an oversight person appointed. But in the end, you have to make it essentially more comfortable for blacks and Latinos. Let's remember what this is like. You live in the firehouse with your fire department people for 3 or 4 days in a row. And those guys, they're white. And they don't, all of them, want to accommodate themselves to the changes of living with Latinos and blacks. Mm. And that's, in my view, it's underlying it is the racism of people that's been allowed to flourish by the leadership of this city, both Giuliani and Bloomberg. And until we can get enough blacks and Latinos into the fire department.
And women.
I was going to ask
women.
About women. Does this cover women as
there
well?
There was separate suits about women, and, right. they are covered. But until we can get that
critical mass of those people,
yeah. It's not going to be comfortable for blacks and Latinos in those firehouses, and therefore they're not going to want to apply. Anyway, that's, I think, one of the problems.
I would think they'd have to implement as well a massive public relations recruitment campaign so that they're going to have to come up with some way to make it seem like a more comfortable environment.
Yeah, well, the environment's a problem. Apart from that, it's a good job. It's a prestigious job. Everybody likes firemen.
It's well paid. It's
well
a good
paid.
Job.
You work for a couple of days, then you're off for a bunch of... And
you cook together.
You cook together. You know,
you have a Dalmatian dog.
Yeah. I think there's going to be a lot of applicants. And now that the test has something to do with the actual firefighting,
right?
They're going to get in.
It's a historic victory. I mean, I put this together, and I think I said it on one of our shows, with three victories the Center for Constitutional Rights has had recently about this city, New York. The center came out of the civil rights movement of the South and Jim Crow. And now I think how much we're doing what its work has always been now in the North. Stop and frisk, basically underlying it, a race case. The fire department case, obvious race case. And we have another case we're in the process of winning on substitute teachers, which are primarily black and Latino, who were paid at much lower rate than the white teachers in this city. And so in this city, this northern city, 50% black and Latino, we've had a fight tooth and nail on three major race cases.
Michael, I hear we're having a contest.
Yes, we rarely run contests on here, and I'm not sure we're going to be able to have lunch with whoever wins the contest. But here's the question you have to answer. Recently, the Washington Post revealed in an AP story that the NSA has recorded every single phone call in one country as part of a program it calls the MYSTIC program, M-Y-S-T-I-C. Every single phone call. And when you read the article, it says that surveillance equipment is now so cheap, and this has been said by my client Julian Assange and others, that you can get one computer for $30, $40, $50 million, cheap for governments, and record every single phone call in a country. Well, apparently, in one of the NSA Snowden documents, it's revealed that a program called MYSTIC has been implemented in one country so far. This was a few years ago, so by now it may include many more countries. And the revelation is that every phone call was taken in, billions of phone calls. They're saved for at least 30 days, including the metadata, but the content and the voice, let me just say, content and the voice, and then they can be searched after they're in for at least the 30 days and who knows how much longer. So here's the contest. Quote, media outlets have agreed not to specify which country was targeted at the request of government officials. First, that's a complete outrage. I mean, that's just disgusting, media outlets. What is that about? I mean, that is...
You mean they know?
Yeah, they know.
They have a gag order.
So the contest is, can we guess which country was the first one targeted in this NSA document?
Armenia.
Everybody, you can't mention your home country.
Oh.
We don't know. We actually don't know. But right. I'm sure it'll be revealed, or I hope it is, because to hold this back in the interest of national security is completely absurd.
Do you think it's an allied nation?
Sure.
I think it's likely an allied nation.
Like Germany.
My guess would be, same with you, Germany.
Could be.
Because it's the most powerful economic country
in Europe. Phone call, in and out.
I mean,
and
if they were recording Merkel's cell phone, I think they went after Germany. That's my guess.
Yeah.
You too.
I agree.
When we say every phone call, it includes all of our phone calls to Germany or from Germany to us, and includes every phone call I or every other American citizen makes in Germany. So it includes millions of American phone calls, U.S. citizen phone calls made from the United States to Germany. Every phone call, assuming it's Germany. But we don't know, so that's the contest. I'm not sure we're going to take you to Wendy's for lunch, if you guess it.
Well, let me ask you, do you think it could be Great Britain?
You owe me a bratwurst.
Could it be Great Britain?
No.
I don't think it'll be what they call the Five Eyes.
Right.
The Five Eyes are the main surveillance states.
I know. Australia, Great Britain,
New Zealand,
Canada.
And us.
And us.
The U.S. Those are the Five Eyes. So it's probably not a Five Eyes country. Okay, so stay tuned, because if someone gets it and it can be verified, we'll get a free lunch. As I said, not at Wendy's, because that's the CIW.
Right.
While they're not boycotting it, it still wouldn't be a place to go until they sign the Fair Fruit Agreement. But it'll be somewhere of comparable value.
What a sport you are, Michael.
Michael, hard to believe it's that time again. The Brooklyn Folk Festival is coming up.
6th Annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, April 18th, 19th, and 20th at the Bell House in Brooklyn. Old-time string bands, blues, jug bands, traditional Indonesian, Balkan music, New Orleans jazz, songwriters, and more. And a square dance, films, workshops,
but fun.
And the famous banjo toss. Ask me about the banjo toss.
What's the banjo toss?
They throw a banjo into the Gowanus Canal, which is a super fun sight.
Ruin that instrument.
It's a sacrificial banjo.
Okay.
But when they haul it in, they got to wear rubber gloves.
To protect themselves.
Last year, a shot putter from Cincinnati won. And you don't get the one you throw in the water. You get a new banjo for it.
Okay.
The Brooklyn Folk Festival, it's at brooklynfolkfest.com. It's presented by Down Home Radio and the Jalopy Theater. Down Home Radio is my son, Eli Smith, and they've got 30 bands. It's a terrific thing. Brooklyn is the center for the revival of folk music in America. So check it out, April 18th, 19th, and 20th, the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
It is an amazing event. I've gone every year and love it. And for you people listening who are over 65, which I know are some of our listeners, there's a smaller banjo they give you to throw. I almost won last year with the tiny banjo.
I don't get why the older people have a smaller banjo.
Because the bigger one is heavier. It's harder to throw. On my various trips to Cuba, this is Michael Ratner speaking, I've a number of times visited the old fortress military base called Moncada, which is located in Santiago, Cuba. In 1953, there was an effort by Fidel and his movement to capture the Moncada Fortress. It ended with the deaths of many, many people, including the capturing of Fidel. And one of the people who was on that mission, which is looked at as the birth of the Cuban Revolution, even though they didn't win victory for 6 or 7 years later, one of the people on that mission was a woman named Melba Hernandez. Melba, unfortunately, died a few weeks ago, and Heidi's going to talk to us a little bit more about who Melba Hernandez was.
Michael, Melba Hernandez died on March 9th in Havana. She was 92 years old, and she was considered a national heroine in Cuba. She helped start the Cuban Communist Party. She was one of the first four members of Fidel Castro's general staff. She'd met him in the early 50s and really helped make the Cuban Revolution, as you mentioned, with an opening volley and attack on the Moncada Army barracks in July 1953. Fidel Castro initially didn't want her to go along with Haiti Santa Maria on the mission, but was persuaded to let them go as nurses to help the wounded. And they were both arrested when the mission failed. They were released from jail after serving 5 months of a 7-month sentence and were used, I think, by Fidel as trusted agents.
Fidel was imprisoned for 2 years on the Isle of Pines. As you said, Melba got out after 5 or 7 months. And Fidel wrote a famous speech called History Will Absolve Me. Now, did Melba play a role in getting that speech out to the public?
Yes. Both Melba and Haiti Santa Maria oversaw the publishing of the text of Castro's courtroom defense of himself and the revolution, which ended up being published under that title.
The speech is called History Will Absolve Me, and I recommend it to everyone. And I also recommend it as a speech to read along with a Rivonia speech by Nelson Mandela. Both of them say why they can no longer use the courts to get justice in their respective countries, in Cuba and in South Africa, and why they had to turn to armed struggle. And that is what Fidel's speech is really about.
I also want to mention that Melba received many honors and served as a deputy in the National Assembly in Cuba and held various government posts. One of those enabled her to oversee the state of women's prisons in Cuba.
When we say goodbye to someone in Cuba, what do we say, Heidi?
Melba Hernandez presente.
Melba Hernandez presente.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've reported in depth on the targeting of environmental activists by federal agents and categorizing their exercise of free speech as terrorism. In a recent Freedom of Information Act request obtained by the Earth Island Journal, the FBI held a day-long strategy meeting with TransCanada Corporation, the company building the 2,100-mile Keystone XL pipeline, in April of 2012. In March of 2012, President Obama made a speech in Cushing, Oklahoma, the state where the meeting was held, confirming the approval of the southern portion of the pipeline toward the Gulf of Mexico. The FBI meeting suggests that the highest levels of law enforcement are involved in monitoring opposition to the pipeline. Our guest is Adam Fetterman, a writer for The Nation, the Columbia Journalism Review, and Earth Island Journal. He joins us to talk more about this story.
Adam Fetterman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Now, you've been writing about environmental matters for a while, and we were interested in your article detailing how the FBI held a strategy meeting in 2012 with TransCanada and industry partners around the Keystone XL pipeline. What did you find?
Right. That particular meeting held in Oklahoma City in 2012, essentially an opportunity for TransCanada to go over security concerns related to their pipeline project, which, of course, is extremely controversial. And from the agenda that we obtained, it looks like they offered their general pipeline security overview as well as what they call an incident history. And from a subsequent meeting they had in Nebraska with law enforcement there, we know that that incident history essentially details environmental opposition to the pipeline. And we don't know exactly what the extent of the cooperation between TransCanada and the FBI is, but this gives us sort of an inkling in what they're doing.
They've got a piece of paper which says TransCanada in the left-hand upper corner and the FBI logo on the right-hand corner. So it looks like they're pretty tight here.
Right. I mean, yeah, that's sort of a remarkable document. And then I actually spoke with a former FBI agent, Mike German, who is now at the Brennan Center, and he was very surprised to see the juxtaposition of the FBI logo and TransCanada at the top of that letterhead, which makes them look like partners.
Precisely. And they had an all-day meeting, first in Oklahoma, and then the state just south of Oklahoma, that pipeline comes down from Canada. It's got to go through Oklahoma and Nebraska. They had another meeting in Nebraska. So
That's right.
It looks to me, from what you've uncovered, that the FBI is like the point man for this corporate adventure in bringing dirty oil from Canada down to the Gulf so they can sell it, I suppose, to Europe.
I think that's right. The FBI seems to be a key player in all of this. And I also uncovered correspondence between TransCanada's corporate security advisor, Michael Magina, and a FBI agent in South Dakota, who he had invited to this meeting in Nebraska. And they seem to be on very good terms. And she, the FBI agent, actually wrote to him, when the pipeline is approved, we'll have to get together and talk about installation through our state. So clearly the company is using all levers of power that it can to get this thing not only approved, but to push opposition out of the way and potentially criminalize dissent and, constitutionally protected political activity.
Apart from who's going to receive it, talk to us about what the burning of this oil is going to do to the atmosphere.
Right. Right. I mean, tar sands oil, which is primarily being mined up in Alberta, is considered, the dirtiest form of oil on the planet. And the extraction process is incredibly destructive and polluting. And to get it to refineries and market requires enormous investment and energy output. Finally, the consumption of that fuel further contributes to global warming and climate change, and this is really why the environmental movement has galvanized around Keystone Pipeline. It's not that they believe stopping the pipeline is going to solve global warming and climate change. It's that this is sort of a line in the sand, as it were. If this project is green lighted, James Hansen has famously said it's game over for the climate. So it really does mark kind of we've already passed so many tipping points, but I guess this, some people believe this may be the final straw.
That's what so alarmed me, Adam. And here you've got Obama in Oklahoma cheerleading for the project, and
yeah,
then you got the FBI coming in behind him with all
right,
the information they have on the Bill McGibbons of the world who are trying to oppose this. It seems to me that there's a collaboration where the FBI is furnishing these corporations with the names of solid citizens who are trying to stop this ruination.
Right. The timing of that is really quite interesting because, Obama was in Cushing at the TransCanada Pipe Yard. It was a speech he gave that was not open to the public, and that was on March 22nd, 2012, and he essentially approved the southern portion of the pipeline then. And about a week before that, the FBI had met with TransCanada employees to start planning this strategy meeting, which occurred then in April. So a lot of, back and forth between the company and the highest levels of law enforcement in the United States against the backdrop of a very serious campaign to stop this pipeline.
Adam, this past August, you wrote in Earth Island Journal that Bryan County Sheriff's Department in Oklahoma actually infiltrated a tar sands resistance training camp back in March 2013, a few months before you wrote the article. And the intelligence from the undercovers was given to the Department of Homeland Security and then used to sort of prevent a planned act of civil disobedience in Cushing. Do you think a lot of that's going on, that kind of infiltration?
I think much more than we're aware of. Certainly we know more about that from Europe, where it's been documented in more detail. But it's hard to speculate about infiltration because by its very nature, it's not meant to be revealed. In this case, it was, based on the way corporations and law enforcement have dealt with environmental activists in the past, you have to venture a guess that it's fairly commonplace. And, that whole episode, I think, is really extraordinary. You had two undercover police officers infiltrating a week-long tar sands camp, which was completely above board. You know, they had promoted it online. They were very cautious and careful about not attracting negative attention. You know, they forbid alcohol or other drugs from the camp, and they took fairly extensive security precautions. But at the same time, they were very open because they want to appeal to as many people as they can. And the information was, as you said, passed along to the Oklahoma Fusion Center, Homeland Security Fusion Center, and then used to thwart this planned act of civil disobedience at the end of the training camp. And I should add that during that same week, the Department of Homeland Security in Oklahoma was communicating with TransCanada and, in fact, shared with them a situational awareness bulletin, which was redacted in the public information request that I filed. So we don't even know, you know, if TransCanada was privy to information that was being funneled from undercover agents or not, but it's quite possible.
And that's the whole scenario with these fusion centers. And for listeners who don't know, there are approximately 76 across the country. They share data among various levels of law enforcement, but also with the private sector, so corporations such as TransCanada.
Right. And what's interesting about that as well is that, you know, they end up taking some of their lead, it seems, from the corporations, which have, you know, very different interests and objectives in mind.
You know, it reminds me, Adam, of the creation of the FBI about 90 years ago, because there were private FBIs and corporations could hire X or Y or Z company. The most famous company in those days was the Pinkerton Company. And then after the First World War, the FBI was installed and the corporations got a break because they kind of nationalized all these private companies, and now you have this secret police spy operations being run and paid for by the government. You fast forward 90 years, instead of having the Pinkertons, we get to pay the FBI to work with TransCanada to spy on us. I wondered what your reflection on that irony is.
Well, in a sense, it's, you know, continuation of business as usual. But I do think it's also important to underscore, you know, the changes that have taken place since September 11th in terms of enhanced cooperation between law enforcement and the private sector under the guise of combating terrorism and protecting critical infrastructure, which is primarily the domain of the Department of Homeland Security, but of course they're all sharing information with each other. You know, I'm in the middle now of requesting additional documents, looking more closely at both the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI's collaboration with the oil and gas industry at large. You know, beyond TransCanada, but obviously TransCanada is one among many who are in the new resource extraction game, which involves fracking and tar sands and all of these ventures that are sort of taking off throughout North America.
Adam, you're doing good and important work. We want to stay in touch with you as these things develop.
Yes, Adam, you're involved in a lot of so-called dirty stuff here, and we appreciate your muckraking. So
thank you very much.
We'll be in touch around the Keystone XL pipeline decision in the next couple of months and hope to have you back on.
Very good.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. continued to discuss the bitter dispute between the CIA and the U.S. Senate committee that oversees it. Last week, the contention erupted when the committee chairwoman accused the CIA of spying on Congress. Senator Dianne Feinstein announced publicly that the CIA had searched computers used by committee staffers examining CIA documents when they were researching the agency's counterterrorism operations and harsh interrogation methods, or torture. She charged that the search violates the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and an executive order prohibiting the CIA from conducting domestic searches. CIA Director John Brennan denied any charge of computer hacking. To talk more about this story and related issues, we're joined today by human rights attorney and contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, Scott Horton.
Scott, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
You know, the last couple of weeks have been filled with information and statements, counter back and forth, between Dianne Feinstein and the CIA over the torture investigation. I think probably our listeners aren't following it very precisely. So if you can just sort of bring us up to date of the overall picture and then some of your thoughts on it. But let's start with the overall picture. What happened? What had happened with Dianne Feinstein all of a sudden going from lapdog to attack dog?
Well, I'd say we start going back about 14 months to December of 2012 when the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence finished work on a massive 6,000-page review of torture practices, including the operation of black sites by the CIA. And this is something that was researched over a period of several years. And this was sent for CIA review and comment, and a war broke out almost immediately between the CIA and the Senate Select Committee.
And that's about a year and a half ago, right?
Exactly, 14 months ago, to be precise. Then over the following seven months roughly, it was point counterpoint, but the CIA was constantly making clear that they believed that there were serious factual inaccuracies. And at one point, after they submitted a statement pointing to things they thought were incorrect, the members of the Senate Select Committee came out and said, now wait a minute, the CIA's own notes about this show that their claims are not correct. That exchange is what has triggered the latest war.
Now, their claims about what, Scott?
It was their claims about, now we're all talking about things that we haven't read and seen, which makes it a little bit difficult to describe them with much accuracy. But it goes to several aspects of the torture program, and particularly whether there was anything useful that was ever drawn out of that program. The Senate report makes very negative conclusions about that. And the CIA has, of course, waged a campaign for many, many years. Remember Jose Rodriguez's book, George Tenet's book, John Rizzo's book. It's largely a book publishing campaign with a movie adjunct, too, ZD-30. All designed to show that, no, that these torture practices nabbed essential information that helped in fighting the war on terror. But now in this case, we come down to a set of particulars about how information was transmitted from the CIA to the Senate Select Committee. So the CIA would not simply turn over documents to the Senate to be used in Senate offices and reviewed. They insisted that CIA classified material could be viewed only at a secure site in Northern Virginia, which was controlled by the CIA, and on computers that the CIA would furnish. And there's a written agreement between the Senate Select Committee and the CIA in which the agreement provides that, yeah, well, this will be the committee site, and these will be the committee's computers. What happened, as it now has become clear, is that certain materials were turned over to the Senate Select Committee, and then the CIA, after the fact, realized that it wasn't such a good idea to have turned over those materials because those materials, in fact, showed the CIA was lying about aspects of its program and public statements. And so they went in and deleted the files that they had already turned over to the committee. I'd say that's right at the crux. And to cover their deletion, they then claim that the Senate had improperly gotten access to these classified materials, which it was not authorized to see. The CIA's acting general counsel, a fellow named Robert Ettinger, then filed a criminal reference with the U.S. Department of Justice saying that there had been a violation of security protocols by the Senate and the Senate staffers, and demanding that the FBI and the Department of Justice investigate the Senate and the conduct of the Senate's investigation. Then I think Dianne Feinstein went to the well of the Senate and delivered a really remarkable speech, about more than 50 minutes in length, in which she talked about this in crisis of the Republic terms, basically setting out how, you know, there had been a campaign of obstruction by the CIA from the beginning, how this had been intensified more recently. In this case, the CIA was violating the Constitution, violating the laws, and undermining the separation of powers in the Constitution. And I have to say, it was a really dramatic speech, a very rare speech. I think it's quite unusual that you get speeches of such eloquence and import delivered on the floor of the Senate. So this was the sort of thing that is going to be printed up and reproduced in textbooks in the future, I think.
Especially, Scott, think about it, as you know, from Dianne Feinstein, who has basically embraced everything the NSA has done and that's been revealed by Snowden. She looked like a total, like, you know, a shill for the NSA, essentially. And then we get this. So why do you think we got this from her?
Well, that's a really important point. I would say it's not just the NSA, it's the Intelligence Committee overall. In fact, I would say if you look at the Democratic side of the Senate Select Committee, there's no question but that the CIA's pick of all the senators, the one they would want to be the chair, is Dianne Feinstein. She's had an absolutely coddling relation with the intelligence community from the beginning. She has been accommodating of all their concerns. She's been someone who takes to microphones right away to provide cover stories when they make mistakes, to apologize for them, to echo their line on almost everything. And so for her to be the person raising these concerns is shocking. I mean, really amazing. And I think you have to say they really had to do something awfully bad to get her riled up this way, and they did.
Yeah, my guess is, I'm just guessing, is because there's a criminal investigation, conceivably, of her own staffers, that she felt this is an outrage and she has to protect them. But maybe it's the deeper issue of getting into what the Senate's doing. In the end, of course, we're discussing a torture report, which we'll get to, but I know Heidi has a question.
Scott, I know the FBI has just started its preliminary investigation, and that inquiry will determine whether they will undertake a full-fledged investigation. How long do you think this will take?
Well, timing is a major question here. Because I'd say we start with the fact that there's a sort of constitutional issue. Can they even do this? It's not clear that there's constitutional authority for the FBI to investigate a Senate investigation. But when they do, even preliminary probes in the national security area in the past have lasted a period of a year or longer before they take some final view. And then you'd have a real investigation. But in this case, remember that the gravamen of the complaint is that the Senate committee and the Senate staffers secured access to classified information that they should not have seen. And I would just say, and I think most legal experts who've dealt with this will agree with this, that that concept is utter nonsense. There is no such thing as security classifications that block a Senate inquiry or block access of Senate staff who have security clearance. The whole function of oversight is that they're able to get access to everything, to compel access to everything, and examine it. So the underlying premise of the investigation is bonkers.
I wanted to ask you about two characters in this whole drama. Ettinger, the attorney, who I remember was the guy that gave the green light to burning those videos of torture. And then John Brennan, who was deeply involved in it all years ago, who's now the head of the CIA. So what role are these two playing?
Right in the middle of it, Ettinger. So one thing that Dianne Feinstein noted in her speech, she didn't mention Robert Ettinger by name, but she described him in considerable detail. And she said the person who's launched this investigation, who made the request for the investigation, is a person whose name appears more than 6,000 times in the course of the
week. His name is on every page, right? Because it's about 6,000-page report, right?
With 160 pages focusing on his conduct. He was the lead operations counsel for the counterterrorism division. That is the division that applied the torture techniques. And he was the person who gave the green light and go ahead for all the dirty stuff. So, of course, he has an immense personal investment in blocking this report, a huge conflict of interest. And I say from things that come out already, like the ethics review of the preparation of the Office of Legal Counsel reports, we know there that the lawyer at the Counterterrorism Center who was providing information to the Department of Justice to solicit those memos consistently made false or incorrect statements to the Department of Justice to get the memos, and that would be Robert Ettinger. So this is a person who is, you know, would, I think, in any normal rule of law state, be under criminal investigation right now, would have his law license under very serious scrutiny, probably would lose it. And he's the person who's driving this whole charade. Brennan, I think, likewise, is someone, he told Barack Obama when he joined the Obama campaign that he had been an opponent of the use of these techniques within the agency. And I can tell you from speaking to many people inside the agency, there's no one I can find who recalls him ever once having uttered those reservations. But it's one thing is clear is that since he came on the Obama team, since he was a senior advisor on intelligence matters to the president in the White House, he has pulled out all the stops to block disclosure of the details of these operations. He vehemently opposed the publication of the OLC memoranda. He opposed release of photographs. He's opposed release of documents. He's opposed release of the Senate committee report. And on the Senate committee report, he says he read the executive summary, and he said it contained many things that he did not know about or that were inconsistent with what he had been told previously by the CIA. So he's basically tried to adopt this position of being outside of things and not really knowing the inside. But it's clear that he let Ettinger loose on Dianne Feinstein and the committee, and he's trying to push things back. Now, we've got to keep in mind here the relationship with the White House, too, which I think is immensely important. And I have a White House source, very senior White House source, who's told me that about 8 months ago, Obama gave a direct instruction to Brennan that he wanted the Senate report declassified and released. And Brennan nodded that he understood and agreed. And since that time, rather than pursuing good faith release of the report, he's engaged in every conceivable bit of chicanery and gamesmanship trying to block it. This is really what has driven the ire of Dianne Feinstein. It's not, you know, I think she accepts the CIA. They're entitled to put in their criticism, to have their views, to make their comments. That's fine. But they're not entitled to, you know, put sticks in the spokes and try and stop the entire process, and that's what they're doing.
Let's say that these documents come out. Do you think that there will be any prosecution? Torture is illegal. It's illegal under the American law. It's illegal under international law. And they quite obviously tortured people. But do you think there'll be any kind of justice at the end of the day?
I think it will depend on what the information is that comes out, the detail, and where it shows the process leading. And I would note another thing that came out around the time of this controversy was disclosure of the fact that the White House has withheld thousands of documents from the Senate committee. And it's just a suggestion made that, well, this is just routine. It's just a matter of executive privilege. There's nothing really special. I believe that that's not true. I think that we've seen a lot of documentary evidence. I mean, in fact, even if you look at John Rizzo's book, or several of the others, Kiriakou's book, you see that there was a line of control and authorization on the use of the torture techniques that went into the White House, where they were involved in deciding program by program and case by case who would be subject to what procedures, and they were receiving reports on what was done after the fact. And this was going into the National Security Council. So there is a huge documentary trail connected with this, and I think the White House does not want to give up evidence of the rather tight control it exercised over this whole program during the Bush administration. I think that is another bombshell waiting to happen. And particularly, we have to consider here, it's not just a question of people being brutalized and mistreated and tortured. It's also a question of homicides, and there are a number of them.
So the Obama administration is covering up for the Bush administration?
Absolutely.
Scott, I have a procedural question. In an instance like this where we have legislators embroiled in a dispute with a federal agency, what is the proper body to investigate if it's not the Department of Justice or the FBI?
Well, that is the basis of our separation of powers. So the Congress should have its own oversight of its own operations. It's not up to the executive to provide oversight. And remember, the function that's going on here is congressional oversight of the executive. So you cannot have the executive providing oversight of Congress's oversight of the executive. It's just theoretically impossible. So the issue would have to be raised within Congress and dealt with within Congress. So it really cannot be done by the Department of Justice. And let me say, there's another particular problem here. You see the CIA trying feverishly to position the Department of Justice as this outside, independent, neutral body which can sort of arbiter and deal with the facts. And that is ludicrous, because the Department of Justice body that's been brought in here is the National Security Division, and the National Security Division basically was established to be a law firm for the CIA. So they work for the CIA, and the National Security Division has in the past been aggressively involved in cover-ups for the benefit of the CIA. So they're involved in the same problem. In fact, I think quite a bit of that's come out in the past, and I think quite a bit more of it is going to come out in the next few months. So the idea that the National Security Division of the Justice Department could in any way be sort of neutral or independent here is ridiculous. They're basically the CIA's law firm.
Scott, this has been remarkable. I have a couple of last questions for you. One is, what do you expect to happen next with this controversy? And if you can close on what we're really talking about here, which is torture, and what do you expect will be revealed when and if this thing ever gets declassified?
I think what I expect to see next is Dianne Feinstein will present the report for an up or down final vote at the end of this month. And I expect to see it be, at this point, a sort of party line vote, Republicans lining up to oppose it and Democrats putting it through. It will then be presented to Barack Obama for declassification. He has placed phone calls to members of the committee in the course of last week telling them if that happens, he will direct its declassification. I think we're not talking about the 6,300-page report. I think we're talking about the 300-page executive summary at the beginning that will be declassified, with the rest to come at some later point. But I think we're drawing closer to its release and disclosure. And what I think there are going to be a number of bombshells, even in the executive summary. They're going to tell us that we still have not been informed of many of the worst incidents that occurred, that there are more torture techniques that were approved and used than we have been told of, that there are more deaths connected with the program than we've been told of, and that this program was to a very high degree managed at the top of the government, involving senior-most personnel in the intelligence community, the Defense Department, and in the White House, and particularly inside the White House.
Well, Dianne Feinstein's committee was set up initially going back almost 40 years to the Church Committee when the CIA was doing terrible stuff. If Frank Church came back from the dead, what do you think he'd say about all of this?
One thing I find is really remarkable is we saw the Church Committee, and there have been a couple of other attempts in the interim too, raise serious structural criticisms, press for reforms, and none of these attempts to impose reform or change within the CIA have ever had any meaningful effect. And in fact, to the contrary, there seems to have been a substantial reaction to them where the CIA has gone even further and further off the reservation. But I think he would note that after 9/11, all controls and restraints were off the CIA, and it ceased accounting to the law, basically, and it ceased providing meaningful oversight. So we really have a serious rogue operation now, which is nothing like the gatherer and analyst of intelligence that was authorized in the National Security Act of 1946. This is a totally different beast.
Scott, I just want to thank you again for being with us. As usual with you, a remarkable interview, and we'll come back to you. Hopefully, the next time we'll know some of the other torture techniques our government has been using. So thank you, Scott.
Great to be with you.
We just finished this important interview with Scott Horton about the CIA trying to disrupt, cover up, and intimidate Congress. Now let's hear a little bit about the origins of the CIA from a book that Michael Smith and I wrote called Who Killed Che?
The foundations of the American national security state were laid with the National Security Act of 1947. The act created the National Security Council and the CIA, granting the new intelligence agency particular powers that were, in the words of George Marshall, the Secretary of State at the time, quote, almost unlimited. Marshall warned President Truman of this before the act was passed. Truman was later to agree with Marshall. In 1948, the National Security Council approved a secret directive, NSC 10/2, authorizing the CIA to carry out an array of covert operations. This allowed for the CIA to become a paramilitary organization, a role that today is openly acknowledged. Since the NSC 10/2 authorized violations of international law, it also established an official policy of lying so as to cover up the law-breaking. As James W. Douglas wrote, quote, the national security doctrine of, quote, plausible deniability combined with lying and hypocrisy. It marked the creation of a Frankenstein monster.
The CIA we got in 1947 is the CIA we still have today. And in fact, it's probably running the country even more than it was back then.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.